John, we're joined by somebody we do a lot of television with over the years, and we covered as a player with both New York teams. That's Al Leiter.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to talking to Al here on the podcast. And this is great timing for Al because all these pitching injuries, his son just called up, had the debut. We'll talk to him about that. His nephew, Mark Leiter, becoming a star now with the Cubs. So a lot to talk about with Al, and should be great fun.
Lots to talk about with Al. And John, I'm going to ask some questions of you about the White Sox, about the Astros, about the two New York teams. We'll play hit and error at the end if you stick with us on the show with Joel Sherman and John Hayden. John, I had jury duty this week. Thankfully, it only lasted a day. I think the wood benches at 100 Center Street were a torture device at the turn of last century, and they've just decided to keep them there. It's why we're going a little later this week. I thank everybody involved in the show so that we could still do it. But John, on the subject of torture, I wanted to ask a few questions of stuff we've seen. One of them is about the Chicago White Sox, who I believe, as we're doing this, are 3-21. Are we about to see a team lose more games than the 1962 Mets, 120 losses?
Well, they're on pace to win 20 games, which is half of what the 62 Mets won, 40 games. So they're on pace to do it. But no, we've seen this before. We've seen this happen. Obviously, they have a lot of stars that are out now, good players. Luis Robert, the most prominent one, Moncada. They missed Jimenez for part of the time. Obviously, they are a terrible team. They can't hit. They're last in OPS. They're last by a long shot in runs. They are awful. They're worse than the A's. They are probably even worse than the Rockies, but it takes a lot to lose 120 games. Not going to happen.
Do you know that the two worst winning percentages in history for since the modern game, since 1900, right now it would be the 125 winning percentage to the White Sox, followed by the 231 winning percentage of the 2024 Marlins. By the way, the Rockies are fourth at 240. So we're watching some really crap baseball out of some teams this year. And John, I talked to an executive the other day, and I asked the executive, "Do you think they'll lose 120?" He said, "I believe in the theory that you automatically win 54 and lose 54, and it's a question if they about the other 54." He said, "Now, I think they might go 0-54 in those, but they would still win 54 games." John, you know what worries me about them? They don't do anything well, and like you mentioned, Luis Robert, he's going to be out a while, and when he comes back, don't they have to be compelled to try to make the Juan Soto trade with him? So, like, they're one great player, maybe they'll wait till the offseason to do it. But they traded Cease when they had a moment to do it. Andrew Benintendi looks like he forgot how to play baseball. It's not good. By the way, my question too, right now, the 16th worst winning percentage since 1900 belongs to the Houston Astros, right? So I'm assuming that's going to get a lot better as the season goes along. Nevertheless, they're 10 games, they're 11 under 500, right? 7-18 as we're talking. It's only 25 games. They're starting to get some pitching back. Verlander last week, Framber Valdez is coming back this week. Do they get to the playoffs?
I don't think so, but that's a good question. They have a shot. I talked to Dana Brown, their GM, a Seton Hall a graduate. He was a player there with Biggio and Vaughn, and he's now their GM. And he professed that they're not giving up. They've got a shot, and I get it. I mean, this is a team that's been the LCS 7 years running. Certainly, Bregman is a lot better than this. I am worried, and I think he is as well, about Abreu. Former White Sox, he looks like he may be done. Unfortunately, had a great career. They may have to call up the kid. I think his name Loperfido. He's got 12 home runs in the minors. Give him a shot. But I mean, I think they've been incredibly unlucky to this point. You've never seen a situation where basically every one of their starting pitchers has been out for some degree. Really incredible, and they're still going to be waiting on Garcia, McCullers, Urquidy. I mean, it's an epidemic, but it's hit the Astros harder than anybody. And I think it's, while they're only six games out and nobody's started great there, I think it's a little bit difficult to recover from 7-18. I think only two teams have ever made the playoffs, some 7-17, one being the Miracle Braves, and was that 1914? That's even before my time. But I'm going to say no, but I'm not giving up All hope on them.
Yeah, you mentioned the other guys, Blair Henley, JP France, Hunter Brown, Spence Arrighetti. I hope I pronounced that right. They started 14 games. They're personally 0-10 with a 9.67 ERA. The Astros are 1-13 in those 14 games. So obviously getting Verlander back, Valdez. Look, you mentioned six out. I kind of still think Texas is really good, and I think it's going to be hard for them to win the division. And I'm just sitting and looking at an AL East where every team is 500 or better. Will all the wild cards come out of that division, making it even tougher for the Astros, even if they get their act together to get to the right number to get in? On the subject of getting in, my question number three, John, after a month of information, the Mets are 13-11. Do you think they're a playoff team?
I think they're a contender. I don't think they'll make the playoffs, but, I think they're a solid team. I think that David Stearns was correct that they are a playoff caliber team. They may get in. If you had to ask me today, and you just did, whether they're going to get in, I'm going to say no, but not by that much. I mean, obviously Lindor, that was a great sign, the two home runs yesterday. Beatty looks much, much better at third base. Obviously, I don't think we were expecting this from Reed Garrett, but he's been tremendous. And then combined with Diaz at the back end, and Ottavino's look very, very good as well. Their bullpen looks solid or better than solid. So they got a shot, but I hate to be negative. I'm going to say not quite.
I'll give a little love to Jeremy Hefner. He was talking Reed Garrett to me like the second week of spring training that he thought they had something with him. So I'll mention that. John, I'm surprised a little bit that their defense, you mentioned Beatty has played well. Their overall defense hasn't been great. I assume Lindor and Nimmo will give them a lot more than they've given them to now. You know, Beatty's bat. It's funny. Last year we went through this with Alvarez and Volpe where there was real questions about their defense, and their defense was superb, and it was their offense that had some real question marks. It's felt like that a little bit with Beatty early this season. I assume, again, that he'll hit. It's going to be a traffic jam between about 84 and 88 wins for that second and third wild card. I think the Mets will be in the jam, but after a month, if I just had a guess, I would think that they kind of fall just short of it. I'm continue to be worried about when they get Senga back and what version of Senga they get after a shoulder injury. On the subject of a New York team, John, to wrap up this first block here on the podcast, the Yankees, do you think they're going to win the division based on what you've seen over this first month?
You know, I picked the Orioles. I tend to stick with my predictions. They've been pretty comparable to the Yankees so far. Yankees have been better than I thought. They obviously, Soto has made a huge difference. I don't think we're expecting this from Cabrera. The pitching, the starting pitching, all those question marks are basically being answered in the affirmative. I think Stroman's been fine. Rodon's been better than fine. Cortez has been fine. Cole will be coming back, I do believe, around June 1st. So a lot of positives around the Yankees. But, I mean, the Orioles are just, I mean, everybody they call up. Now I understand that Holiday is struggling, the top prospect in baseball. But, I mean, Kerstad now up. I mean, he was as good as Couser in spring training. They just have so many great young players. I just think they're the better team. I could be proven wrong. I may end up with egg on my face. But I think Baltimore is just terrific. They won 100-plus games last year, right? And everybody assumed the Yankees were going to run away with it or certainly win the division for some reason. The Orioles are great. They really are.
Yeah, I picked the Orioles. I would stick with the Orioles right now. You know, if I was going to give a little more love to the pairing that's no longer together, John Sterling and Susan Waldman, would you say that's baseball, Susan? The worry coming out of spring training with the Yankees is what about their starting pitching without Cole?
Yeah.
And their starting pitching has been great. 3.01 ERA. It's the third best in the majors. I think it's so vital that the five guys kind of just stay healthy to get to Cole. And they've gone round and round. Now, you know how quick that could happen where you lose a guy or two. But the fact that they've been durable through a month, all have made their four or five starts to date. Luis Gil has been good. He's, you know, still having some walk issues. But the stuff when it's over the plate is pretty close to not hittable. He's been terrific. I will say this, John, you mentioned Cole through June 1st. As we're speaking here, it's April 25th. He hasn't been off of a mound yet. I assume he has to go through something that looks like a 6-week spring training. It's a little bit like Senga when they kept giving me timelines and I kept asking people in the know and they were like, yeah, just ignore the timelines kind of thing. And he ended up on the 60-day IL. I think would both New York teams right now sign up for July 1st for these two guys, considering they're not off the mound even, and it's almost May.
Yeah, I don't know what to make about Senga, but I mean, when I've seen Cole, he felt pretty good about June 1st, and I know it's late April. You could do spring training in less than 6 weeks, I think. I still think that June 1st or thereabouts is a possibility. So I don't think the Yankees would. With the Mets, it's kind of a mystery. So I'm going to say that they probably would sign up for July 1st. At this point, we haven't really heard any real timetable with him. So, I think July 1st will be fine for them.
On the subject of pitching, one of our favorite guys to talk with over at the MLB Network, one of our favorite guys to cover when he was both a Yankee and Met, was Al Leiter. He joins us next on the show. John and I are so happy to be joined by one of our colleagues at the MLB Network, Al Leiter, three-time champion, World Series champion, key player on two of those, and obviously a key player on the 2000 Mets, who won the NL championship and played in the Subway Series against the Yankees. Al, thanks so much for joining us. I think there's a myriad of reasons to talk to you, but obviously your son Jack made his debut last week for the Rangers. I think they showed you on television more than Jack during that broadcast. And you said something leading up to this while we were off air that kind of leads to a question I want to ask. And I was going to ask it even beforehand, which is you love to talk pitching. And you said you love to mix it up. What is the fine line when it's somebody with your DNA? You love Jack Leiter, but where do you intercede and not intercede when there's coaching going on? I'm sure there's a fine line there because there's probably nothing you like to do more than talk pitching, and probably a few things you love in the world more than Jack Leiter.
Great question, Joel. Hi, John as well. So that was awesome. Unfortunately, I say unfortunately, but amazing experience, right? He found out 2 days before, and unfortunately for him, the line wasn't great, but the stuff is there. And as I continue to share with him, you know, it's a craft and a nuance, right? I mean, here's a kid who's got, you know, exceptional stuff, but you know, there's pitching. And I constantly remind him, you know, watch the guys with lesser stuff and really pay attention to what they're doing, right? You know, how many 2021 fastballs are they throwing? If they are, is the command impeccable? How many 3-2 breaking balls do you see? How many 2-0 changeups do you see? They're pitching. You know, Max Scherzer pitched in a rehab start at Round Rock last night. And that was kind of what I alluded to with Jack, just in that little snapshot, Joel. But it is much more difficult for me. You're right. I do love pitch. I do love talking pitching. I really do. I did as a player. I thought it was important as a fellow starting pitcher on my staff, whether I was doing really well or not, was to engage with the guys. Hey, what did you see? Hey, Joel, you pitched 2 nights ago. What did you see with his swing? Hey, John, you're pitching tomorrow. We're similar. What do you got? You know, and that thing, you know, it's the genesis of a lot of other potential tentacles to maybe you pick something up, right? So I'm careful with Jack because of what I did, Joel, and I never wanted him to pitch. I dreamt of him being Robin Ventura. I really did. Get dirty, dive, you know, preferably a left-handed hitting third baseman, right? Play every day. You can hide there often, go 0 for 4, maybe with a walk, you know, and you played okay. You get on the bump, you know, it's all on you. You guys know that, covering as long as you have and no baseball. So unfortunately, he had a good arm. It is much more difficult for me to be honest, and I'm being honest, to really tell my son what I think sometimes, because I don't want the love of a father-son to get in the way of something like baseball or pitching, even though it's his livelihood and it was my livelihood. So I am way more honest and direct with other pitchers than I am my son. I'll be honest. And I'd love him more. I mean, you know, my family, my kids. But so I'm careful. And it's a little frustrating because some of the things, and he's in a great place. He's in a really good place right now. But when I heard some things that's being, you know, suggested to him, you know, I don't say anything. I'm just saying, ooh, you know, and I try not to react, but and I'm careful how I get a point or a message across, either through a surrogate of somebody else, or I just let him get the bumps and bruises. It's a sport, as you guys know, it's a sport of insecurity. It's a sport of failure. And you have to go and experience it. You can't be talked about it. Well, this is what's going to happen, and this is how you should react. You just got to do it.
Jack obviously is extremely talented, number two pick overall. I watched that game. He was throwing 96. He seemed to be in the corners. They were hitting him, obviously, and he was sent down after the game. So where do you think things stand right now? I know, tell us what you think. I know you don't want to say too much to Jack, but where do you think things stand now, and how was that for you to see that? Because I'm sure you were sat in a lot of stands where he was dominating forever.
Yeah. So it's been hard, Joel, John, because, you know, you guys have kids, and, you know, whatever they're doing and performing and whatever they do in life, it's, you know, the feeling and the emotion is what it is. And in my case, I go to a place of somebody who was lucky and grateful enough to have experienced 19 seasons in the big league. So I pitch along with the guys. I pitch along with the guys when I watch on MLB Network, or, you know, flip on the YES Network or SNY. I'm like, I immediately know what they're going through. So I turn on that, like, what would I do? Like, how would I pitch? Ooh, yeah, I saw that. Is he going to throw that? You know, and it's just, that's where my brain goes. Jack's good. He's in a good place. Obviously, the results, you know, they are what they are. I got an amazing amount of texts. It's unbelievable. Ex-managers and players and guys I never, you know, have spoken to in a long time that responded. What I knew was going to happen is funny. One of my texts, and I've got – it was amazing, the people reaching out, including you two guys. Rick Cerrone, my catcher for my debut in 1987 was Rick Cerrone with the Yankees. And Rick, we were going back and forth. And you guys know Rick. He's got a big personality. He's funny. And, you know, I didn't shake Rick Cerrone. And the quandary for a young pitcher to have the respect and also the confidence to know what you're all about and what you've been doing. For as much as I shared with Jack, I said, Jack, everybody's trying to help you. You know what you've been doing since spring training, and you know your few starts in AAA and pitching really well. I said you got to share that, because, you know, in this case, Jonah Heim, the catcher for the Rangers, like, he's calling what, you know, the scout report for the Detroit Tigers. And not that to get in the weeds on that, but, you know, there's nuances that you own. That is your strength. I'll never forget, John, when I took a lot of stuff from a lot of pitchers in my career. One of them from Dave Stewart in Toronto was, you got to let hitters hit your best stuff. And Stu was a fastball split with a little breaking ball to get guys off his split finger. That's what he was, and with a plus fastball velocity. And he was like, in all scout reports, you know, and Galen Sisko was a pitching coach, and they'd say, well, watch out for this, watch out, good fastball hitter, good fastball this, good fastball that. And Stu would say, Galen, can he hit my fastball? You know, and Stu has a higher pitch voice, as you guys know. And that, you know, and it resonated with me. It's like, you know, pitch to your strengths. I know I'm getting in the weeds here, but, you know, Jack's going to be fine. Knock on wood, hopefully gets a lot more opportunities. And, you know, again, the learning of – you're pitching, you know, who are you? What makes you successful? What are the things you need to improve on and continue to improve on?
Al, you know, you said something interesting in the first answer. I'm assuming you don't want to say names, but can you give an example? Because I think this is the constant war between people of your generation pitched and current of how you think about the art and the battle. It's, you said, there's some stuff I didn't love that I hear. Can you give an example of something you didn't love that your son heard where you wish you could have just said, Jack, I know that's your double A pitching coach, the pitching coordinator, whatever.
Yeah.
You got to throw that away, man. He's never been on the bump in a big game or whatever it is that you felt.
Yeah. Yeah. Great question. I'm not one of those guys, because one of my favorite pitching coaches of all time, Larry Rothschild, he got barely a cup of coffee with Detroit. You guys know Larry well. I love Larry. Love Larry. And Gil Patterson, who also got a cup of coffee, you know, a few starts back in the 70s with the Yankees, one of my favorite pitch coaches. So you don't have to be, you know, a crusty veteran major leaguer to have good information. And I'm also finding now with a lot of these organizations, and I don't know whether it's just economics, they can't pay for an ex-big league guy to be an A-ball coach, which I would. If I owned a team, I would have major league coaches down there. I think it's so valuable. If you're trying to develop players, well, dang it. And the end result is the big leagues. I want big league experienced guys that can at least relate the big league experience. And it doesn't make it, not all big league coaches or ex-big leaguers are good coaches. So I know it's not easy. Here's the thing, Joel. I think analytics and TrackMan and Edutronics and Kinetic, you know, all of that, all of the technology that's out there, I would be in it, because I was also ahead of the curve with scouting reports, and I paid for it personally before we started getting binders from clubs, or, you know, it used to be the advanced scout, right? You had an advanced guy that would go 3 days, 4 days ahead, write up a report, give it to the hitting coach, pitch coach, and the manager. And that was our scouting report. But when I first got called up, so I got ahead of that with video, and I had people do and stuff for me to get it. So my head's not in the sand on it. But what I don't like, and I know I'm being long-winded, but what I don't like, and I'm careful, and I'm very careful of translating my opinion to my son, is that we're seeing a lot of players, not only pitchers, but hitters, they're playing to the computer. And that is a compliment. And I've always said that TrackMan data and all that stuff is terrific. That is a tool for you to try to either work on something or give you a better focus and narrow the attention to a weakness or a strength, but don't play to that. And I have a problem with that. And I really do. So when I'm hearing like, no, that's the slider they want. And I'm looking at it, I replay the video. I'm like, that's the slider they want. It's 2 feet outside. What are you talking about? No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the -3 inches and the +4 inches on the vert horizontal spin axis. Beep, beep, beep. But I'm like, oh my God, you're thinking this stuff in a game? Like, wow. Mine was battle. I'm going to mentally will myself through this. Yes, I have a game plan, but man, when it comes to game time, play ball. Like, I can't be thinking about, oh yeah, that's the one, or go back in the clubhouse or whatever they do now behind the dugout and say, hey, what is my slider got enough vert on it? What? Get the guy out. So I know it sounds kind of like Neanderthal-ish, Joel, but there's a fine line there. You want me to go on side day 2 days later? My pitching coach says, hey man, your slider was crap. It was flat. You got around it, the side of it. Here, take a look, man. See, you're -3. Those two games in Atlanta and Philly, look at this. It's -4. Blah, 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 blah. You know, we got to get your hand a little bit. Bit, bit, bit. I'm like, great. Got it. I understand that. But don't tell me that crap in the game. I don't want it. It's too late. It's ding, ding, ding. Pop. We're going. You know, it's the gladiator syndrome. So it's a little bit of that that I think needs to, you know, we're always pulling it back to that place. And I think it's a crutch for a lot of guys. I think it's an excuse. I think arm injuries is part of that. When we're training kids to get the D1 scholarship, you got to throw at least 90. There's kids seventh, eighth grade trying to throw 90 miles an hour. Look, your medial epicondyle is not developed enough. You rip the bone off. They don't rip your UCL. It's the bone that comes off. It's called literally your elbow. Like, what are we doing? So if we could stop training stuff all the time and teach kids how to pitch, stuff will come.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. I mean, Al, you pitched 19 years in the big leagues. I remember early on, there wasn't a lot of talk about pitch counts until I think Dallas Green threw you about 248 pitches. How many pitches?
163, Joel.
Yeah, 163 pitches. And you came back from that. Obviously, you had some arm injuries in your career, but you lasted 19 years. What else? What else is going on in Major League Baseball right now? Because I think it's an epidemic at this point. I mean, it's very unfortunate that all these great pitchers are needing Tommy John surgery or some other surgery or out, frankly. And what can be done about this besides what you alluded to just now?
So you know, both of you know, because you're in the middle of it and you have a lot of information. They know that baseball, Major League Baseball, commissioner's office knows that this is something that we have to figure out, right? Because it's one thing, you know, that 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 Tommy Johns a year, you could go on that Google Doc, and I used to follow it, and I stopped following it because it was like scary. Back in the day, you'd have like 8, 9, 10 guys a year. Now it's like 60, 70 guys a year. All right. It's not there's not a silver bullet. There's not. I'm not smart enough, and there's not one, you know, Zoom call or conversation in a boardroom to figure it out. But I would start with this. John, I really believe this. I think somehow, some way, if we could start highlighting pitchers and appreciate the craft. I always think about Tom Seaver. He was my idol. And, you know, he used to talk about pitching like art. He did. He said it's a beautiful art, and the craft and the nuance of changing speeds and hitting the spot. Like, it wasn't about like, hey, I threw 95 and my slider was great and my vertical was this. It wasn't. It was about pitching and the beauty of that. So I'm getting to it. And I think there's several answers. But what I would do if I could, I would turn the radar guns off. I would. And I would see how that feels and looks. I think we have too many people in the game because they never played. They rely on the computer, and they should, right? If they never really played, like, and this is my binky, the metrics and the analytics and all the TrackMan data, which is really, really, really good stuff. But this is what I lean on, as opposed to my eyeballs looking and seeing, yeah, that wasn't a good slider. Oh, yeah, you're right. Look at this, the computer. Yeah, no, I didn't need that. I saw that, you know. And we get back to the pitcher looking at home plate and the batter. Because there's often, it's not just my son. John, I'll talk to guys and I'll say, did you see that with his front side? He has no shot of hitting anything away. You don't have to go outer third or black. You go outer half. And I get a pitcher, I was like, huh? I'm like, you didn't see that? You didn't see that front side and leak? And the hip went a little bit? And you're like, no. And then they asked me, I was like, you saw that? I said, yes, I used to throw pitches purposely out of the zone to get a reaction on a certain pitch. So I know I'm getting in the weeds. I would shut off the radar guns. And now we have stadiums, John, as you know, they have the TrackMan data on the scoreboard. So forget about that. Like, I turn around, I see my spin is 2200 and throwing me 2400. And now do I need to spin it harder? I didn't know what the hell my spin was when I was throwing. I wanted to throw 7 scoreless. And if my pitch count was down, I would beg Bobby Valentine to keep me in the game. That's what I did. I have no idea what my spin rate was. I knew when I went 3 1/3 and you guys were writing that I stunk because I didn't get out of the fourth inning. I get that. You know, I would occasionally, I'm lying, because I did throw hard when I was younger. I was in the upper 90s. But when I got older, what I did look at was my velocity separation from my fastball to my curveball. And it was mostly because I went from mid to upper 90s to low 90s, right? So what am I going to look up? Look up on the scoreboard, it's 93, whoop-de-doo, right? Whereas Ramondo Benitez used to throw it, and no sooner he'd look out. he would have finished the pitch. It was out in left field. Armando, yeah, right hand. He'd go, whoop. And he'd look back to the – well, if you're throwing 100, crap, I probably would too. But I wanted to maintain at least 13, preferably 15 miles an hour separation of my fastball to curveball, because the eyeballs can't register that, right? If you throw it right, it pops out of your hand, you're going to get some drag. Guy's going to be a little bit fooled. So I'm sure it's pie in the sky stuff, John, but I would turn the radar guns off, and I would start teaching kids, you're going to gain velocity. Your velocity is not going to be what it is as an eighth or ninth grader. You're going to get bigger and stronger, et cetera. And forget about the radar gun. It's probably delusional, but I think we start with that.
Yeah.
You don't care about, I'm sorry. One more thing, Jill. John, we don't care about longevity. We have organizations that know that they draft guys. And you know me with mechanics guys walking around the MLB Network. Like, I look at guys and go, ooh, you know, I don't know if that's 3 years, 2 years, 4 years, 5 years. That's not a good delivery. Guy, they don't care. It's like, all right, he throws 94 to 99. We're going to teach him a nice tight slider, get his ass up to the big leagues as quick as possible because he's going to break down. That's kind of, and then let's just, you know, we'll recycle these guys. We're going to get as many 95 to 100 mile an hour arms.
You know,
teach good deliveries.
You know, Al, you hit a spot that I talk about quite a lot where I say before the game, it's a debate. In the game, it's a competition. Like at some point, you have to throw the debate away. John mentioned the 160-ish pitches Dallas Green had you throw in April of 89. I'm old enough. I was covering the game. That was my first year on the beat. I was there when you were traded for Jesse Barfield later that month. I was there when your brother came to the Yankees. And now both of your children are in the major leagues. The Leiters have become the first family of Major League Baseball. Are you amazed that it's your family? It's two brothers and sons of brothers. Your nephew and your son have both been the best. By the way, Mark Jr. is a heck of a reliever for the Cubs.
Yeah, and he doesn't throw 95, and I love it. And he's got an unbelievable amount of confidence. He always has. He's had a chip on his shoulder. Mark Leiter Jr., Chicago Cubs, nice reliever. He went to the baseball powerhouse of NJIT in Newark, New Jersey. I don't say it disrespectfully, but that was his offer. And all he's ever done was prove people wrong. Minor leagues, Phillies, got to the big leagues, went to Toronto, he had a few surgeries, and he has grinded. He's got a great split finger, Joel, and he throws 91, 92 miles an hour. He's a great example for my son to look at what Marky's doing. So there's a snapshot of pitching with a guy with a plus pitch, split finger, that's doing a great job in the big leagues. What I couldn't believe, Joel, and obviously it came out with the research and the facts, I didn't realize that's never happened. And I damn think that's cool. And I'm so proud of, you know, my kid and certainly my brother Mark, is as you covered for a short time before he got traded to Detroit for Torey Lovello, that it's never happened. I know we've had grandfathers. I know we had fathers. We had brothers. We had father sons. I'm surprised for 150 years that somewhere two brothers didn't have two sons. So really cool. Obviously, I hope Jack gets more opportunities.
Yeah, I'm also old enough to have covered Mark, your brother, and a terrific, terrific guy. Really, really enjoyed him. And congratulations to his son. Mark Jr. is doing a terrific job. But one thing I always wanted to ask you about, we alluded to the big pitch count before. You had a big pitch count at the end of the Game 5 of the 2000 World Series. Take me through that exactly, what happened. Obviously, Soto had that seeing eye hit that ended it. I don't remember how many pitches you threw, but take me through the decision for you to stay in the game, what pitches you were throwing, and what you were hoping to do there.
Okay, so I knew it was the last game I would pitch. I wasn't going to pick up a ball until December and get ready for spring training of 2001. So I had a great relationship with Bobby, and Bobby knew my nuttiness. There was a method to my madness, if you will. He knew I was prepared. He knew I gave it my all. He knew I wasn't a jerk just mailing stuff in. And I also took the responsibility as a front end guy when I knew that there was a need to save a couple of the guys in the pen, right? This is before we had eight guys down in the pen. You know, it was six, you know, maybe a club, depending upon how the rotation was going, maybe seven, but it was mostly five or six. So, and I used to tell Bobby, I said, Bobby, you know, my trouble is the first inning, first couple innings. Like I was a guy, a feel for the umpire, feel for my stuff, feel for that cutter, you know, where Piazza would catch it, right? Bam, boom, you know, and I guess guys start chasing. So the eighth inning, and I don't have the box score in front of me. I always say I struck out the side in the eighth, but maybe Joel, you could check this while I'm telling this story. The eighth inning of game five of the 2000 World Series, I pitched well in game one. We had a lead, you know, late in the game. We ended up losing to, the game got tied in extra innings. We lost to the Yankees at Yankee Stadium. So I felt really good about facing them, and I was in a good place, you know, been in the big leagues for a bit. I think I struck out the side in the eighth inning, and I came in, and I know my pitch count was getting there. And I'm like, it's the eighth inning. Oh, by the way, it's 2-2. It's 2-2. I gave up two solo jacks. Bernie, who was struggling or wasn't having a great spring, he got me on my patented cutter, popped at left field. I forget what inning was that. And then Derek Jeter, I threw him a 1-0 changeup, which what the am I doing? That's not my pitch. I always used to throw tilt slider down and in. Derek had a tough time because he'd smother. What Derek was good at was like keep his hands in, punch to right field, as you guys know. I throw him a 1-0 changeup. Derek reminds me years later when I was doing Yes Network stuff. I would joke with him. I said, I can't believe I threw you a changeup. It's 2-1 in like the sixth or seventh inning. We're winning the Mets. Mm-hmm. And he then comes back. He goes, yeah, not only did you throw me a 1-0 changeup, you threw me back-to-back changeups. And then I'm like, oh, my God, did Mike call this? What was I thinking? And the only reason why I'm saying this, because you guys know the way I pitched. I was high fastball, cutter, curveball in the dirt. Like I'd sprinkle two or three changeups in. So after striking out the side in the eighth, Dave Wallace, the pitching coach, comes down in the dugout. And I knew his MO. I was like, how you feel? How you feel, kid? And I went, how to beep, beep, beep. How do you beep and think I feel? And I was being demonstrative and loud because I wanted Bobby V to hear it at the end because I didn't want to get taken out of the game. I'm like, this is cool as Game 5 of the World Series. Like, we need this. I don't want out of this game. So I get the first two outs in the ninth. I walk Posada on a 3-2 pitch that I still think is a strike, of course, because I always about the strike zone. And then the next pitch, Brocious hits a little over Robin's head at third, first and second. And then the next pitch, Luis Soho hits a 10 hopper up the middle. Boom, ball gets thrown away from Mike, and I get taken out of the game. I cry. I won't say cry, but John, it got close to full-blown tears because I gave it my all. I knew it was daunting for us to come back because Mariano Rivera was going to come in the bottom of the ninth, and I'm like, damn it. Like, and I started crying a little bit because it was so exhausting.
Yeah, you know, being in the ballpark for two games, fives in Queens, different stadiums, one watching you talk your way into it and one watching Matt Harvey talk his way into it, right? And it had bad outcomes both times for the Mets. And I actually still remember Posada was not a great base runner, not fast. He still almost got thrown out at the plate.
I know.
The play at the plate.
And if you look at where Mike was set up, you know, Jay Payton made a nice strong throw, and I don't know where the hop was. It was obviously in front of the mound. Mike was actually behind the baseline because I looked at that every different angle. And I don't know whether if he was in the baseline, does he get bowled over? Does the ball knock out of his hand? But, like, he was whatever. Look, yeah. it was 2-2 in the top of the ninth. We got two outs. And I think, look, the Mets put me in the Hall of Fame last year, and I am so grateful. I grew up a Mets fan. I had the coolest thing. New Jersey, get to the big leagues with the Yankees, won World Series in Toronto, and then Marlins. I was living in South Florida. Anyway, I got back, you know, got to play for my team as a kid. But as I said at the Hall of Fame induction last summer, thank you to Bobby V. Because – there are so many other people that put players in position to get the opportunity to either do it or don't. And if your manager doesn't have the confidence, and we're talking about an outing of 143 pitches to that game and also the 163rd game, that the playing game in 99, you know, there's a couple other ones sprinkled in there with the Mets, but those games, Mets fans, if I'm walking to Manhattan, they bring up those games. And it's because, look, I'm coming out a 5-0 win. We're winning in Cincinnati. They would take me out now, right? So you go two-hit shutout. Instead of a two-hit shutout, it's eight innings of two-hit or one-hit ball because Pokey Reese got a double in the ninth.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't feel the same. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Guys. Yeah. It's probably not even eight innings. They probably take you out after six or seven because they're racing to the bullpen in today's game. It's probably a – look, Al, we could we really didn't get into your career. Well, I'm sure we could have asked a ton of questions about that great Toronto team coming up with the Yankees, Billy Martin. So this is my my invitation that we need to do this again soon. And John and I appreciate you joining us on the show.
Yeah, sorry to long answers, but I appreciate you guys, and I know you guys are great baseball guys, and hopefully it wasn't too far in the weeds for your viewers.
Now this show's the weeds. This is the show in the weeds. We should retitle it In the Weeds.
Yes. Well, I think if we called it In the Weeds, a different kind of group would listen to and watch us. But that's probably a different situation. Al, thanks so much. We'll see you up at the network soon.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
John and I thank Al Leiter, of course, for joining us on the show. John, hit or error?
I'm going to go hit. I've been very, very positive lately. I was just out in L.A. with the Mets. The Dodgers aren't playing to 103 wins like we expected, but Ohtani, unreal. I mean, the guy is an incredible hitter. I think that's a bargain at $700 million deferred. He leads baseball now as we do this in OPS, in slugging, in hits, in batting average, in about 10 other categories I can't think of at the moment. He is an amazing, amazing ball player and will be even better when he starts pitching, whether that be next year or the year after, but they're still saying next year. I got to give a hit to Ohtani. A lot of pressure on him. He's not feeling it, apparently, at least in the performance at bat.
You know, John, I have a question before I get to my hit or error. You mentioned coming back to pitch. We're seeing how valuable he is when he's just hitting. Would he be even more valuable if he just gave up the pitching and went to the outfield and turned into probably a gold glove level outfielder to go along with this level of offense? I don't know. I've been thinking about it a lot more. I obviously love the story. It's such a great story to have him doing both. And I hope he does do both again, because I'm a story guy. I don't know. What do you think when you're watching this?
Yeah, I'm a story guy. I want to see him pitch. It's fantastic when a guy's a top pitcher and a top hitter, maybe the top hitter at this moment. Anyway, I mean, if he can pitch, he should be pitching, I think. Maybe it'll be safer for him to be the closer. I don't know. They have a good one in Phillips, but I want to see him back on the mound. Yeah, I probably would be a great outfielder as well, obviously with a great arm, but I'd rather see him pitch.
On the subject of great hitters, my hit is on one of them. I'm going to give a hit this week to Jose Altuve. Things are going wrong in Houston just about everywhere, but not at second base for the Astros, not at the top of their lineup. Sitting 350, he's got over 1,000 OPS, 6 homers, 3 steals. And John, I am not doing this to piss off Yankee fans. I swear I am not, because I understand how much they dislike Altuve. To me, he's the closest thing to Jeter we've had since Jeter, because he's consistently just terrific. And big moments make him bigger. He is not, he rises. He's like Jeter. He has like all these memorable moments. And, you know, we're not going to remember him as like an all-time great, but like Jeter, for a team that defies the crapshoot in the postseason by going to at least the ALCS in 7 straight years, he helps defy the crapshoot like Jeter did by playing so great at big moments. So I give my hit this week to Jose Altuve, and I compare him to a guy who I know Yankee fans wouldn't want me to compare him to.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I would put Jeter in the category of all-time great. And Altuve as a Hall of Famer. I know when we mentioned the Surefire Hall of Famers, we talked Verlander, Scherzer, you know, other players, and we don't mention Altuve, but to me, he's a sure Hall of Famer. I was watching the game last night in Chicago, reminded me of college. Late April, it's 30-something degrees. He's wearing a ski mask, and, you know, it's a home run. They're down 4-2. It's a home run in the ninth inning to pull them closer. They did end up losing. They're now 7-18, but just a fantastic player. And let's not forget, and I know Yankee fans are not going to remember this, but he was one of the few guys who did not take the cues with the trash can. He didn't want to do it. He didn't. I don't know that it was because he had more integrity, but he didn't like the idea of doing it. He thought it wouldn't help him to have an idea what pitch was coming. I don't know. The reason, he didn't do it, and he's being unfairly blamed, as I've said a million times. No one's going to listen to me. Even the people who are listening to this podcast, no one's going to say, okay, you're right. We're now gonna cheer Altuve. That's not gonna happen. That ship has sailed. But I'm with you. He is comparable in many ways to Jeter, and he should get more respect than he does.
Yeah, you know, John, the ultimate proof about the guy's career is we could assume now he's not getting any trash can banging. Even if you did, we could assume now he's not wearing any buzzers if you assumed he was doing that. And he's continued to be a historically great hitter. So I'm going to believe that he
would.
Was
he 5'6" or 5'5"? I don't know.
Yeah, whatever it is.
It's unbelievable. It really is unbelievable to see him not only in the field. In the field, he looks like a ball player. In the clubhouse, he looks like a regular guy. He doesn't look like a ball player. And it's amazing. It's amazing. But he is an all-time great.
Yep. On the subject of all-time greats, John, who are our producers who help us through the show?
Jake Brown, you can always get that name correct, Joel, and Dan Shalom. I believe that's correct. You could say Shalom. That's nice also, right? It's not his name, but it's close.
Well, it's both hello and goodbye. Let me get through this so we could get to goodbye. Don't forget Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Give us a listen. Give us a rating. Send us a review. The New York Post Sports YouTube page to see us on this. And keep sticking with us all season on the show with Joel Sherman and John Heyman.